Julia Ochaka's new novel, The Buddha in the Attic, is about a group of Japanese women known as picture brides who crossed the Pacific Ocean in the early 20th century to marry men living in the United States whom they have never met. The only link they have to these strangers is a photograph which may or may not look like or even be their future husbands. They dream of a life of luxury and leisure and instead end up doing backbreaking work on farms or in laundries. Some become maids and some prostitutes. The novel begins on a ship and ends with World War II, when these women, their husbands, and their Americanized children are rounded up and interned in camps. Julia Ochaka's mother, uncle, and grandmother were interned, and her grandfather was arrested, accused of being a spy after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and he, too, was interned in a detention camp. Julia Ochaka joins us on Radio Times to talk about her new novel, about her writing, her family history, and it's a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
So good to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I'd love to have you read from the very, very beginning of your new novel.
Okay. Just to set it up briefly.
Yes.
This is the entire novel is told in what I call the we voice. We being a group of 100 plus young picture brides. And the first chapter is set in the steerage compartment of a ship bringing these young women over from Japan to America. And the title of the chapter is Come Japanese. On the boat, we were mostly virgins. We had long black hair and flat wide feet, and we were not very tall. Some of us had eaten nothing but rice gruel as young girls and had slightly bowed legs, and some of us were only 14 years old and were still young girls ourselves. Some of us came from the city and wore stylish city clothes, but many more of us came from the country, and on the boat we wore the same old kimonos we'd been wearing for years, faded hand-me-downs from our sisters that had been patched and redyed many times. Some of us came from the mountains and had never before seen the sea except for in pictures, and some of us were the daughters of fishermen who had been around the sea all our lives. Perhaps we had lost a brother or father to the sea, or a fiancé, or perhaps someone we loved had jumped into the water one unhappy morning and simply swum away, and now it was time for us, too, to move on.
And that's Julia Ochaka reading from the very beginning of her new novel called The Buddha in the Attic. And I was just so struck with this notion of we, you know, in a sense, a chorus of women.
Yes, I tried writing the novel the first time around from the point of view of just one bride, but it felt kind of flat. And I just ran across so many interesting stories in my research that I wanted to weave them all in. And I was looking through my notes one day, and I just saw this phrase that jumped at me that I'd written weeks before, which is now the first sentence of the novel. On the boat, we were mostly virgins. And when I saw that, I thought, that would be a good voice in which to tell the story.
Or a series of voices, mm-hmm. or 100 voices mm-hmm. in this case. But it also got me thinking when thinking about an immigrant story is that there is no one immigrant story. I mean, here's a boat, as you say, in steerage with 100 women coming to the United States. There's no one story there.
No, and there was no typical. I mean, there are some typical stories, but each one was different in its very own particular way.
And that first line, on the boat, we were mostly virgins.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew once you saw that, that was the beginning of this novel?
That gave me
the
idea.
It's a very provocative sentence.
I wanted to snag the reader right away. But, you know, that did give me the idea to use the first person plural, which I found to be almost a joyous voice in which to write. And almost, I mean, I guess I see the book almost as being like a sung chant in a way.
Mm-hmm. But the idea of mostly virgins, right?
Mm-hmm. Some of these women had what we would call pasts. There were many different reasons for leaving Japan.
This was what the begin. The book is set in the beginning of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Was this unusual at this time for these picture brides to come to the United States?
No, it was very common. I mean, thousands of people. His grandmothers came over as picture brides between 1908 and 1920, when the practice was banned. So it is a very common first generation story. It was not unusual at all. And I think around 30,000 women came over during those years.
And picture wise, because they had either sent a picture of themselves or they had gotten a picture of a man that was looking for a
bride. It was complicated. The Japanese, their husbands to be were Japanese immigrants who had come over earlier in the century to work. And by law, they could not marry a white woman. If you were a white American woman and you married a Japanese immigrant, you would lose your citizenship. So when it came time for these men to marry, there was nobody there for them to marry. So they would arrange to have these brides sent over through matchmakers. And it's not as odd as it seems to us, because back then in Japan, all marriages were arranged through matchmakers. So the young women, who were often poor girls from poor villages, would exchange letters and photographs with their future husbands and correspond for a bit before they got on the ship and sailed over.
But as we find out from the book, and I don't think anything this would surprise anybody, sometimes those pictures were of somebody else. It might be a better looking husband to be, younger version of themselves.
Very often, and the men had misrepresented themselves. The photographs were often doctored, sometimes 20 years old, sometimes it was their best friends, you know, their best handsome friends photograph. And most of the men were, or many were poorer than they claimed to be.
And in some of the correspondence, they would talk about these fabulous jobs that they had.
Uh-huh.
And,
you know, or some of them were photographed standing in front of their master's mansions. So.
Right. But it's not unlike what might see on Facebook or social network or some of the dating sites that you see today, right?
Exactly, except for it's like an internet date, but it's a date for life. I mean, there was no backing out for these young girls once they arrived in America. Most of them were too poor to afford the ship passage back home. And in Japanese culture, you don't divorce anyway. So most of them stuck it out.
And as you described, these were women that were in steerage, I guess, on the other levels of the ship would be more
first class passengers. Right. Yeah.
And steerage was a pretty horrible place to be.
It was difficult. I mean, the voyage could be very, very grueling.
And from across the Pacific, how many days would they spend?
It varied depending on the weather, but from 2 weeks to, it could be a month, 5 weeks.
And if they had stayed in Japan, I'm trying to imagine their lives if they had stayed in Japan.
I think for many of them, life, might have been a little bit easier than the lives that they ended up living in California. I mean, many of them ended up working as migrant laborers in the fields, but Japan was a very poor, overcrowded country of farmers, most of whom did not own their land and had to work for somebody else. Famines were very common. So they might have had to endure a lot of hunger and difficulty if they had stayed in Japan. Also, it was a period of immigration. So many men were leaving for Manchuria and for America to work. So there was a shortage of men in Japan as well, which was another reason for these young girls to leave.
And do these photos still exist?
Probably in families.
In families.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Have you seen them?
I've seen only in books, but actually I was out in California on book tour, and I met my second cousin, and her grandmother was my grandmother's older and prettier sister, but she came over as a picture bride. And
she did,
and she said, which I didn't know before, and she said, my cousin was saying that the first thing her grandmother said when she saw her husband, she looked at the photo and she said, oh, he's so short. You know, she had had this image of a very tall, handsome man.
Well, of course.
Of course.
So where did this idea for this novel then come from? I mean, was it talking to family members or others who could tell these stories?
When I was touring for my first book, people would often come up to me afterwards and tell me that their grandmothers or their great aunts had come over. That's what I love about touring, is people just come up and start telling you the most fascinating stories about their family. So I heard this story over and over and over again. And I thought it was, even though it's a common first generation story, I felt like it really hasn't been told yet. Mm-hmm. And it was just such fascinating material that I really wanted to dive into it.
One of the things that you write in this current book, the first book was called When the Emperor Was Divine, and in this new book, The Buddha in the Attic, girls must be present without appearing to exist, and I was thinking about that, and I know that's shouldn't be shocking, but nonetheless, it's impossible to do, is it not?
I think it is. But that really is how they were brought up to behave, is to be almost invisible and to serve their men loyally.
And this was in Japan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also in America as well. I mean, I think that continued, that attitude of men towards women continued in these marriages.
Remind me of how sometimes people talk about children to be seen and not heard.
Mm-hmm.
That you could
mm-hmm.
exist, but we will not acknowledge you.
But then you get to grow up, at least, if you're a child.
Right. And another thing, you write, it's better to marry a stranger in America than grow up old with a farmer from a village. Was this a common belief, or was that you
writer? Actually, it was a common belief. I mean, these women were under the impression that America, you know, was the land of milk and honey, and that you could just find, you know, money on the streets, and that they would be able to earn a lot of money. And some of them dreamed of going to America, meeting their husbands, working very hard, and maybe perhaps going back to Japan after 3 or 5 years with the money that they'd earned.
But this was also a place that where they didn't speak the language. First of all, they didn't know their husband, but you said that's not unusual to have a matchmaker.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But here they are in a strange land. They don't speak the language. The food is different. I mean, everything is different.
I think
they
had no idea about what they were in for. But many of them were eager to leave. Some of them, on the other hand, were kind of sold off by their fathers for the dowry money. Some had passed. That was another reason to leave. But but many of them were very kind of hopeful in the beginning.
Yeah. And pass would include, what, anything, right? Secrets, love affairs.
A child.
Scandals, a child.
Yes, an affair. You know, some women had married before, and perhaps her husband had passed away, and it would be very difficult for them to find a new husband if they remained in their village. That was another reason to leave.
And I'm trying to imagine putting myself in their shoes, you know, arriving in, what, San Francisco or some city in California, you know, with this photograph, looking for this man that's going to be my husband. And the one in the photograph is not the person that I'm staring at.
And they, I mean, it's just so dramatic. I think that they're landing. I mean, the husbands that were also looking at these young women and trying to match faces to photographs. But I think there it was more likely that you would have a match. Whereas for these young women, I think they had no idea. I mean, staring at just the crowd of men on the dock who were often shabbily dressed, poor farmers. They didn't find the man who resembled the man in their photograph.
And there's, again, that sort of moment of I guess, imagining then, this is what my life is going to be with this person that I have never met and doesn't look anything like this photograph that I have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did you write this in a kind of fever pitch? And the reason I ask that is the writing is so spare and so intense.
I mean, my fever pitch that lasted for 8 years. I mean,
is that right?
I'm so slow. I mean, I'm I'm very slow to compose, and I did a lot of research before I began to write. And I'm constantly revising and paring down as I'm writing. And I was also constantly reading my sentences aloud to myself and out loud as I was writing, because it really seemed like a very much like a told an oral piece.
And it had to sound right.
I had
besides be right on the page.
It had, I mean, rhythmically, it had to sound right, and I sometimes could hear the rhythmic pattern of the next sentence that I wanted to write before I knew the exact words to drop into that pattern.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And again, Julie Otsuka is our guest today on Radio Time. She's got a new book. It's her second novel. It's called The Buddha in the Attic. And again, her first book, written a couple of years ago, in the beginning. Actually published in 2002, is called When the Emperor Was Divine. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania's Fells Institute of Government supports WHYY. The Fells Institute offers a Master of Public Administration degree designed for working professionals in the government and nonprofit fields. Classes are held on weekends and evenings to help part-time students balance work and school. A Master of Public Administration and Fells Open House will be held on Wednesday, October 5th at 5:30 p.m. Details online at fels.upenn.edu.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Lewis about his new book, Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World. It's about how several European countries got to the verge of default. Included in this new third world he writes about is the state he lives in, California. Lewis is also the author of Moneyball and Liar's Poker. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The Greater Wildwood Chamber of Commerce supports WHYY and presents the Greater Wildwood Fabulous 50s Weekend, October 14th and 15th. Highlights include a Friday night dance party featuring Jerry Blavitt and a live concert featuring five 50s acts, with the headliner being Little Anthony and the Imperials. Also on Saturday is a street fair, open to the public with live music and vendors. For tickets and information, gwcoc.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Julie Otsuka. Her new book is called The Buddha in the Attic. It's a novel about Japanese picture brides who come to the States in the early part of the 20th century to marry Japanese men who are, in a sense, total strangers. They learn to adjust to this strange new land, and Julie Otsuka is reading from her new book, talking about some of the research into the history of these picture brides. We'll be talking about her family's history as well and how she became a writer, because she initially was going to be a painter. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm interested, too, as a writer. It seems to me it's hard enough to create and then identify with one character, mm-hmm. but you've created 100 characters. Were each of them, were they real to you as individuals, or did you think of them as a group?
Always, I think as a group. Sometimes I could get sidetracked in my research and follow somebody's story probably further than I should. But no, I just wanted each sentence to be like a brief window, just a glance into somebody's life, but not an entire life story. Maybe it would hint at a story.
Exactly.
That was enough for me.
You were telling us when you write it, it's a matter of paring down a sentence, and I do want to have you read another section from the book, but it's what, stripping away extraneous words or making the sort of music of the language work?
It was the music, I think, that propelled me in the writing of this novel.
Where it just had to have a certain kind of cadence to it?
Exactly, yeah. It was the rhythm.
Can you set up this chapter? And I'm just going to have you read from the very beginning of
okay.
this chapter.
Okay, this is... The young women have arrived in America, just arrived. They've just met their husbands, and they are about to spend the first night with their husbands. First night. That night, our new husbands took us quickly. They took us calmly. They took us gently but firmly and without saying a word. They assumed we were the virgins the matchmakers had promised them we were, and they took us with exquisite care. Now let me know if it hurts. They took us flat on our backs on the bare floor of the Minute Motel. They took us downtown in second-rate rooms at the Kumamoto Inn. They took us in the best hotels in San Francisco that a yellow man could set foot in at the time. The Kinokuniya Hotel, the Mikado, the Hotel Ogawa. They took us for granted and assumed we would do for them whatever it was we were told. Please turn toward the wall and drop down on your hands and knees. They took us by the elbows and said quietly, "It's time." They took us before we were ready, and the bleeding did not stop for 3 days. They took us with our white silk kimonos twisted up high over our heads, and we were sure we were about to die. I thought I was being smothered. They took us greedily, hungrily, as though they had been waiting to take us for 1,001 years. They took us even though we were still nauseous from the boat, and the ground had not yet stopped rocking beneath our feet. They took us violently with their fists whenever we tried to resist. They took us even though we bit them. They took us even though we hit them. They took us even though we insulted them. You are worth less than the little finger of your mother, and screamed out for help. Nobody came.
And again, that's Julie Otsuka reading from her novel, The Buddha in the Attic. And I should say to our listeners that goes on for several more pages. And it's a horrifying read. I mean, yes, there are moments of gentleness and tenderness, but there are also these moments of violence and terror.
Yes, and I think many of these young women, I mean, some of these women were 13, 14, 15 years old. So they were very, very young. And some of them didn't even know, had no idea about what was about to happen to them. Their mothers had not told them what to be prepared for. So I think it was a violent shock for many women. And that was really their first night in America.
And the phrase you use over and over again is "they took us," which is both sort of old fashioned. I mean, it's vague. You know what I mean? They took us.
These men claimed them. They claimed their wives as their own.
What was it like to write that? That paragraph there.
Actually, it was. I had a lot of fun writing it, even though it's a very, very, it's a difficult chapter, but I just thought it was such an unusual setup to have, just to tell the night of a mass deflowering. Just the idea I found really compelling. I couldn't do that much research, so
yeah.
I had to really use my imagination. Although I did, I mean, I did run across Encounters in some of my research.
Oh, you did? Actually talked about this first night?
Or hinted at something that may have happened.
So as a writer, this is fun, to use your words.
Well, it just seemed like an unusual setup for an unusual scene. I think I felt like I would never get to write that scene again. Yeah. There were no other circumstances under which I could.
Did you have to edit? I mean, did that require a lot of paring down?
I'm constantly editing as I'm going along, so nothing ever comes out right the first time. And I probably worked on this for weeks before it sounded right and had the right shape.
Right. You also go on to write about where these women end up, many of them working on farms in agriculture.
I'd say more than half of them ended up working, many of them as agricultural laborers, many as migrant laborers, and living in various migrant camps. They were constantly moving from one farm to another and working for different white bosses.
Anyway, can I borrow your book?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you can just pass it over here. I mean, any way to know... I mean, they had gotten these letters saying, you know, I'm a bank president. You can come and live with me and pick daffodils in the yard. I mean, this is a very different reality for them.
I was actually, I was doing a reading in Pasadena 2 weeks ago, and three people came up to me afterwards from the audience and said that their grandmothers had come over as picture brides. And one woman said that her grandmother had been under the impression that her husband was very well off, but he ended up being, he was an itinerant carnival worker.
And
she worked very, very hard for the next 20 years, and life was very difficult.
In the carnival? Doing something?
I think just doing anything. Yeah.
You also, and I'll just read a couple lines here, they admired, this is you writing here, obviously, they admired us for our strong backs and nimble hands, our stamina, our discipline, and you go on to say, we were faster than the Filipinos and less arrogant than the Hindus. We were more disciplined than the Koreans. We were sober than the Mexicans. We were cheaper to feed than the Okies and the Arkies, both the light and the dark. A Japanese can live on a teaspoonful of rice a day. We were the best bred of worker they had ever hired in their lives. These folks just drift, and we don't have to look after them at all. And this is, I guess, how the white bosses viewed these Japanese workers.
They were seen as being very desirable and cheap workers. And they didn't, most of them did not complain, and they worked very, very hard. And they were nimble. Their hands were fast. Their backs were strong. They did what they had to do.
Our unusual ability to tolerate the heat. I mean, this is sort of based, and we were small, right? So it was based on...
So they were closer to the ground.
Now, in your research, did you come across things like
this? Oh, exactly. Yes, I did. I mean, almost every sentence is pulled up from my research. So, yes, I did. They were considered more desirable than other races for work in the fields.
Also working in laundries. Other mm-hmm. what other kinds of occupations?
Many of them ended up, those who ended up in what I call Japan towns in cities, often ended up working in laundries or in restaurants or as maids for wealthy white women, or as live-in maids with their husbands. Or their husband might be the gardener and they would be the cook.
Well, you also say that being a maid, though, would be frowned upon in Japan.
Oh, it's considered the lowest of the low in terms of professions, waiting on another woman. So some of these women would lie to their families back home about what it was that they were actually doing and say that life was actually very fine.
Can I have you read another section? And this is, and I'm just passing the book back and forth here.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of these women working as a maid.
Yes, and this comes from the chapter that it's called Whites. And every paragraph is we, the Japanese women, referring to the whites. And this one is about their domestic Japanese maids working for white women. It was their women who taught us the things we most needed to know. How to light a stove, how to make a bed, how to answer a door, how to shake a hand, how to operate a faucet, which many of us had never seen in our lives, how to dial a telephone, how to sound cheerful on a telephone even when you are angry or sad, how to fry an egg, how to peel a potato, how to set a table, how to prepare a 5-course dinner in 6 hours for a party of 12, how to light a cigarette, how to blow a smoke ring, how to curl your hair so it looked just like Mary Pickford's, how to wash a lipstick stain out of your husband's favorite white shirt even when that lipstick stain was not yours, how to raise up your skirt on the street to reveal just the right amount of ankle. You must aim to tantalize, not tease. How to talk to a husband, how to argue with a husband, how to deceive a husband, how to keep a husband from wandering too far from your side. Don't ask him where he's been or what time he'll be coming home, and make sure he is happy in bed.
And again, Julie Otsuka, a reading from her new novel called The Buddha in the Attic. I mean, that sounds almost like an etiquette manual, right? This is how you behave in America.
Yes, and they were very, very observant of their bosses.
Because they were, in a sense, they could see what was going on in the house.
Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And it was also, I think you had an easier chance of learning English if you were working for a white family.
There's also a description of when one of these women, I guess, has the house to herself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the family has left, and she's in this, you know, it's probably a big mansion, and it's hers.
She's finally alone.
She's finally alone.
Yeah, and I think she finally feels like herself. Right. She's not under the watchful eye of somebody else.
These women, they're married, they begin to have children.
And that, I think, for many of them is when they first began to feel at home in America. I think many of them were very, very lonely with their husbands, and also many of them lived in very remote areas. Mm-hmm. As tenant farmers. And they often had very large families because you needed children to help with the farm work. And I think that is when they began to be more committed to their lives in America, when they started to have children.
Some say, you know, I picked favorites. I mean, this, of course, happens in families, and that each of them has their own reaction to having these children.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And often the first son was right. He was usually the favored child. But I think for many of these young women, they were just overwhelmed by the project of motherhood, because on top of working 12 hours in the field, they would have to come home and then start cooking and taking care of the children, whereas the husbands could kind of relax.
Right.
So they were tired all the time. And some of them died young of overwork.
Just because it was just a relentless amount of work that they had to do. You mentioned J Town, or I guess Japanese towns.
Uh-huh.
What were they like?
They were usually maybe 2, 3, 4 blocks long. And back then, they existed in many cities in California. It was you would only hear Japanese spoken on these blocks. All the stores, the signage would be in Japanese. All the stores were owned by so. You could close your eyes and almost imagine that you were back home in Japan. So I think for many women, it was very comforting. Some of them, never ventured beyond the 4 blocks.
Right. And many people crowded into, I guess a single room apartment.
Yes, kind of crowded, thing. Very, very cramped, dirty, smoky apartments.
And I guess working in laundries, working in restaurants.
Bathhouses, groceries. I mean, every business that you can think of was, it was their community. So everything was very, very local.
When did your family come to the United States?
Actually, my father came over after the war. So his story is very different. He was in Japan during World War II and can imitate the sound of a B-29 bomber flying over his little village on its way to bomb Tokyo. My mother was born in Berkeley. Her mother, my grandmother, actually came over Her father was a Methodist minister who came over from Japan.
Your mother's father?
My great-grandfather, my grandmother's father. And he came to America in 1927 for the World Sunday School Conference. And my grandmother was the youngest of six daughters, and so she was the daughter who was designated never to marry. She was supposed to take care of her father till his dying day. She managed to get out of Japan in 1929. She had a visa to come speak about education. She had been a teacher in Japan, so she came to America. She joined her father, who was proselytizing up and down the West Coast, trying to raise money for the church back home. And she gave a talk about education in a Japanese Methodist church. I think it was in San Jose. And she must have put out the word on the QT that she was looking for a husband. And so some of the women in the audience heard her, and they felt very sorry for her because she was 29 and unmarried. And that was considered, she was ancient. So they set her up with her future husband. They had a whirlwind courtship. And so she bolted from her father. He disowned her. He went back to Japan alone without her. She was supposed to take care of him, remember? Mm-hmm. But she figured this is the only way that she would ever be able to marry and start her own life. So she never went back to Japan after that.
Was there any contact between her and her family?
She had two sisters, mm-hmm, who were also in California, one of whom, I think, I don't know, there was bad blood. Something happened, and even on her sister's deathbed, they did not speak. Wow. The other sister, which is my second cousin's grandmother, she lived close by, so they live several blocks apart in Berkeley, so she had some family.
She must have been quite a woman in 1929 to come to the United States and, in a sense, defy her father.
She was furious at her family. I mean, she never looked back, so... I think she really did take her life, mm-hmm, into her own hands, and it was difficult, but it was hers.
And who was this guy that she married?
He was actually a very successful businessman, and he was, I think he was 15 years older, and he was the general manager of a Japanese owned import company in San Francisco, the North American Textile Company, North American Trading Company. And I've seen a brochure from the 20s, and their main product, I think, was canned crab. I think it was called Namco canned crab.
And this was his company?
It was his company. So they actually lived fairly comfortably before the war. But then once he was arrested, life was kind of turned upside down for them.
Well, and he was arrested at what, a day or so after Pearl Harbor?
He went to work on December 8th, the Monday after Pearl Harbor was bombed, and he didn't come home that day. So my grandmother had no idea where he was, and so she waited for several days, and then she got a postcard from the Immigration Detention Center in San Francisco where he was being held.
What were the charges? I mean, what was he accused of?
Well, he was on the list of men who were considered to be security threats. So it was because I think he was a prominent businessman in the community. So it was often the community leaders who were rounded up first. So the community was basically emasculated. The leaders were taken away. And he would have had contacts with Japan because of his business.
And that made him a suspect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're almost having a break here, but your book also includes The List. It's well known, although I guess maybe not well known enough. There were the known dangerous, the potentially dangerous, and the pro-Axis inclination people.
Yes. And the entire population of Japanese on the West Coast had been under surveillance by the FBI for years. So, and it was known that they were not a security threat. That was a known fact. There were also Italians and Germans on the list as well. So some of them were targeted and arrested right away, too, but they were never incarcerated as a group. Right.
In fact, you say that the Japanese were on the top of this list.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with Julie Otsuka. Back in 2002, her first novel was published, When the Emperor Was Divine. When the Emperor Was Divine, and her new book is called The Buddha in the Attic. It's about picture brides who come to the States in the early 20th century, marrying men who are total strangers. They do learn to adjust this strange new land. We'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you overweight, tired, and sleepy during the day? Do you snore at night? You may have sleep apnea. A University of Pennsylvania research study is looking at the effects of sleep apnea treatments in improving risk factors for heart disease. You may qualify for this study if you're between the ages of 18 and 80 and not currently using CPAP. Further details are available by phone at 215-823-7809. Penn supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The Occupy Wall Street movement has now spread to other cities. What do protesters want? Also, teaching foreign-born doctors how to treat patients in Iowa, including classes on how to talk about the Hawkeyes and farming. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Lancaster City Arts is proud to support WHYY. Lancaster City Arts, 125 art venues, all within one walkable community. From galleries, art studios, museums, and an art college, to music, poetry, dance, photography, professional theater, and symphony, it's an opportunity to experience something different in an art scene that's quite unexpected itself. Lancaster City Arts. The journey starts online at lancasterarts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Our guest, Julie Otsuka, had plans on being a painter when she studied fine art at Yale. Instead, she has become a writer. She's got two novels, When the Emperor Was Divine, and her new one, The Buddha in the Attic. We are talking about her new book, her research into the history of picture brides and some of her own family history, and also how she became a writer. And lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. This later part of this new novel, When the War Comes, and these brides, they're married, they have children, many of them do end up in these internment camps. Does that feel autobiographical to you because of your family?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this is the one part that I did know something about. I just wanted to tell a little anecdote about my mother.
Sure.
When she is now in the late phases of dementia, but in the early phases, she began telling this story over and over again that I had never heard before, and it was about her last day at school in the world before she was sent away to camp. And she was in the fifth grade at Lincoln Elementary School in Berkeley, and her teacher asked her to stand up and announce to the entire class that Alice, which was my mother's American name, would no longer be with them, and then had everyone say goodbye to her one by one. And my mother kept saying, as she was telling the story, that she said, oh, I was so embarrassed. I was so embarrassed. And I actually think that this was an act of goodwill on the part of the teacher. I don't think she meant to single my mother out and make her feel humiliated. But she just could not stop telling the story. Mm. So I think that leaving was a very powerful memory for her.
And she, along with her mother, I guess.
And her younger brother.
Where were they sent?
They lived in Berkeley. So everyone in the Berkeley area was sent first to it was a temporary center where they spent the summer of 1942, and that was at a racetrack in San Bruno, which was south of San Francisco, because the permanent inland camps had not been built yet. They hadn't finished building them. They were, in horse stalls. There were also some new barracks that were built that were in the middle of the horse racetrack, but most of them lived in the stalls, which had only very recently been cleaned and not very well. So the conditions were very unsanitary. And then at the end of the summer, they were sent inland on a train to a camp in Topaz, Utah, which is in the desert in southern Utah.
And have you been to that camp or what's left of it?
I didn't want to visit it while I was writing my first book. I wanted to build it in my head during the act of writing. But several months after I finished the book, I was actually invited to go out to Utah. So I swung down to Delta, which is the town closest to the camp. And there's a woman there who's been teaching about what happened during World War II for years. So she took me out to the camp, and it really feels like you're just at the ends of the earth. It's extremely barren. There's nothing for miles. And you can see the foundations of the barracks, the concrete foundations. And at that time, the land was it was littered with rusty nails and shards of crockery. And also, weirdly enough, the original barbed wire fence was still there.
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
Sort of the ghost of the camp.
Yes,
right?
And because things are preserved very well in the desert, too.
So how long was your family there?
They were there for 3 years.
Wow.
Until September of 45.
And was there a school there for children?
Oh, there were schools. Yes, there were schools. There's a mess hall, which is where they ate. There was a co-op. But the quality of teaching was not so good. So I remember my mother saying that when she came back, she was really afraid that she would not be able to cut it. They were reading Ivanhoe in class, and she just didn't feel like she was quite up to it.
And did she Did your family talk about this, or was this something that, that people just sort of turned their back on?
No, I think it was very repressed. I actually didn't know anything about what my grandfather had gone through during the war until we found these letters in my grandmother's fireplace that she had wanted to burn. We were moving her out of her house and into a residence for the elderly, and that's when we discovered these letters that he had written to her during the first year of the war from the camps where he was being held, to her and the children in the camps where they were being held.
And he was being held, and as you said, he was arrested right after Pearl Harbor and what, detained?
In a series of camps that were run by the Department of Justice for dangerous enemy aliens. So it was a whole separate series of camps.
And he didn't, I mean, besides these letters, that was really your connection to his
experiences? Yeah, I was very young when he died, so I didn't know anything about what had happened to him. And my mother would tell stories, a few stories about camp, but I don't think she ever let on, you know, as to how horrible it really was for them. And I think that was very common. I think many Japanese families, they didn't discuss camp, as they called it, at all.
Because of the shame?
Because of the shame. And I think it's also very Japanese, just not to dwell on your troubles and to move on.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from your book. And this is, again, you can set that up for our listeners, and we'll get some callers in.
Yeah, the chapter is called Last Day, and it's about the Japanese on the West Coast as they were leaving for the camps. Last Day. Some of us left weeping, and some of us left singing. One of us left with her hand held over her mouth and hysterically laughing. A few of us left drunk. Others of us left quietly with our heads bowed, embarrassed and ashamed. There was an old man from Gilroy who left on a stretcher. There was another old man, Natsuko's husband, a retired barber in Florin, who left on crutches with an American Legion cap pulled down low over his head. Nobody win war, everybody lose, he said. Most of us left speaking only English so as not to anger the crowds that had gathered to watch us go. Many of us had lost everything and left saying nothing at all. All of us left wearing white numbered identification tags tied to our collars and lapels. There was a newborn baby from San Leandro who left sleepily with her eyes half closed in a swaying wicker basket. Her mother, Shizuma's eldest daughter, Naomi, left anxiously but stylishly in a gray wool skirt and black alligator pumps. "Do you think they'll have milk there?" she kept asking. There was a boy in short pants from Oxnard who left wondering whether or not they'd have swings. Some of us left wearing our very best clothes. Others of us left wearing the only clothes we had. One woman left in fox furs.
And again, Julie Otsuka reading from her new novel called The Buddha in the Attic. There's a mention of the crowds there, I guess, people that were taunting.
Or there could be people who are not taunting, but just neighbors who are curious to see, you know, and I think often relieved to see their Japanese neighbors being taken away.
Do you think they saw them as dangerous or suspects?
I think many of them did.
Enemy aliens?
Yes. I mean, I guess the fear was that if Japan were to attack the West Coast, that the Japanese Americans would rise up and assist the incoming invading army.
And one got the sense, even from your book, that whole neighborhoods just became ghost towns.
Yes, yes.
Emptied.
Yes, overnight.
And their belongings, perhaps?
Their belongings were, I remember my grandmother telling me that she had locked up everything upstairs in her house in Berkeley and wrapped chicken wire around all of her belongings and then put two padlocks in the door as if that that would prevent anyone from stealing their things. But obviously there was nothing left when they came back. Mm-hmm. And there were also government warehouses where people could store their things, but they too were looted.
And I'm assuming for some coming back to a house and finding someone else living there.
Yes, if you were lucky enough to own a house. Japanese, by law, were also prevented from buying property. My grandfather, though, had bought his house, as many did at that time, if they had the money to do so, in his children's name. So his children were U.S. born. They were American citizens. So I think when they turned 18, they could turn the deed back over to their parents.
And does that house exist today?
It does, yeah.
You've been there?
I grew up in nearby Palo Alto, so we would visit that house when I was very young.
What
so.
Does it look like?
Now, it got a little run down, I think, with the years, so.
Could use some work?
I think it's a fixer-upper, as they say, but it's still there. And I have very clear memories of that house, my grandmother's house in Berkeley.
Wow. Let me get some callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499, talking about many things with our guest, Julie Otsaka, including the fact that during World War II, many Japanese-Americans were rounded up and interned in camps in this country. Let me get Chris from New Hope to join our conversation. And Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to share a story. My grandparents, through a church organization, had rescued a family from an internment camp on the West Coast. And they had apparently owned a restaurant, and that was taken away from them. And they ended up living with my grandparents in Warminster, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
The mother was an outstanding cook, and so she cooked for my grandparents. And the husband was a wonderful gardener, so he gardened. But it was well-intentioned charity. However, my grandfather ended up really destroying the head of the man of the family, the father, who had two boys, by usurping his role as head of the house. And he sent the two boys to college, but should have given the money to the father to give to the sons. So he usurped his sort of his position in the house, and it really destroyed him.
Wow, Chris, that's an amazing story. Julie, and any thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I think camp for many of those fathers was a very emasculating experience because often the children would end up just eating by themselves in the dining hall. So there was no more family unity. And these fathers, who had been very, very strong authoritarian figures before, really lost all of their power.
And they weren't working, in a sense. I mean, they weren't employed in the sort of traditional sense.
Right. They had no more authority at all. And you could leave camp if you were able to find a sponsor and a job in a non-West Coast state. So it sounds like that is what happened with your family. But that's a very fascinating story. I've never heard it quite told in that particular way before.
And Chris, just one quick question. Do you know where those children are?
No, both of the parents are dead, and I don't know where the two boys are. I know that one went to MIT, but I don't know. I never kept in contact with them.
Well, Julie, I appreciate the call to radio. Excuse me, Chris, I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
Sure.
Thanks a lot. And again, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. I mean, it must be interesting because you've written two novels to hear, you know, in a sense, to go across the country and hear some of these stories.
Mm-hmm.
This is quite an unusual one, but obviously touches some of the things that you have been writing about.
Yeah, no, and it's, I mean, I have heard some fascinating stories, you know, as I've been touring. And, you know, I like to hear stories of well-intentioned people trying to help. That always, to me, gives me hope, because there were good people out there. The Quakers especially worked very hard on behalf of the Japanese. So I think it's important that those stories be told and heard.
Do you feel like there are parallels today? I mean, we live in difficult times.
Yeah, I mean, I finished my first novel in June of 2001, so right before 9/11, and I had no idea that it would reverberate in the way that it has. And I think for many Japanese Americans, there are just a lot of eerie parallels that they felt about now, post 9/11, and how Arabs and Muslims were being targeted and singled out as the enemy, and what had happened to the Japanese Americans right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And Guantanamo, dangerous enemy alien, is not that different from being called an enemy combatant. Military tribunals, and my grandfather was tried, but was not allowed to have a lawyer or, I think, see the evidence against him. So these trials were very unfair.
Was he found guilty, not guilty?
He was eventually, I don't know what the outcome of his trial was, but he was allowed to on parole to visit his wife and children in Utah because a relative had died of a stroke, and then he was allowed to stay there from that point on. Mm. So I guess in the end, not guilty.
Yeah. I'm curious because I was reading about you that you had, I guess, aspirations to be a painter.
Mm-hmm.
Do you paint or is writing become your painting?
I think writing has become my painting. Although for years, all throughout my 20s, all I wanted to do was paint. And I began graduate school in painting when I was very young and dropped out after 3 months, moved
Why
to New
that?
York.
Why is that?
It was the first time I had been forced to produce under pressure, and I was young, and I think I kind of cracked under that pressure of the upcoming critique, and for the first time in my life, I just felt paralyzed. I just couldn't paint, so wow. I draw. I know it was quite
like writer's block for
exactly.
a painter.
Exactly, and it was horrible. And I dropped out of the program, and I moved to New York, and I just started temping, and then after a few months, I really wanted to paint again, and so I enrolled at the New York Studio School. And I painted for a couple of years, and then I kind of hit that wall again where I become just very critical of myself as I was painting. So I finally stopped for good.
And discovered writing?
yes. I mean, when I stopped for good, I was working in the evenings in New York as a word processor for a construction management company. So I had these long days to fill, days that I had spent previously in art school. And so I began going to my neighborhood cafe every day before I went to work. And I began reading a lot of contemporary short stories for the first time. And I didn't know anything about contemporary fiction. But I've always loved to read, and I just love the sensation of being lost in somebody else's story and just being taken out of myself. And after a couple of years, I just tentatively tried my hand at writing. And I mean, I you know how you take things for granted that you've always been able to do well. I mean, I could always write, but I never felt like I had a story to tell, which mm-hmm. now seems odd because now it seems like the story of the internment would be the obvious story
of course,
for somebody like myself.
Of course.
But actually, when I applied to graduate school at Columbia in creative writing, I entered as a writer of humorous fiction, not of serious work at all. So,
but then gravitated towards the more serious stuff.
In my second year, yeah.
Well, Julie Otsuka, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for
joining us today on Radio Times. And she does have a new novel, and it's called The Buddha in the Attic. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.